She did not rise to the smile. A great deal of your writing coincides with my own conviction. As for your action, if I had been a man and in your position, I might have acted as you did. Peter stiffened, resenting any allusion to the taking of Flight 070. And again she seemed to understand instinctively. I refer to your entire career, General, from Cyprus to Johannesburg, and including Ireland. And he relaxed slightly. Why did you refuse the Namco offer? She asked. Because it was presented with the unstated conviction that I could not refuse. Because the terms were so generous that they left a strange, unsatisfying odour in my nostrils. Because I believe that I would have been required to perform duties in line with the reputation I seem to have acquired since the taking of Flight 070. What reputation is that? She leaned slightly towards him, and he smelt her particular aroma. The way perfume reacted upon that petally smooth skin, heated by the exertion of the climb up the hill. She smelled faintly of crushed lemon blossom and clean, healthy, mature woman. He felt himself physically aroused by it, and had an almost undesirable impulse to reach out and touch her, to feel the warmth and glossiness of her skin. A man who makes accommodations, perhaps, he answered her. What did you think you might have been asked to do? This time he shrugged. Perhaps carry bribes to my one-time colleagues in NATO command, to induce them to consider favourably the products of Namco. Why would you believe that? I was once a decision-making officer in that command. She turned away from him and looked out across the special greens of an English winter landscape, the orderly fields and pastures, the dark wedges and geometrical shapes of the woods and copses. Do you know that through Altman Industries and other companies, I control a majority shareholding in Sedler Steel, and naturally in Namco? No, Peter admitted, but I cannot say I'm surprised. Did you know that the offer from Namco was in reality from me, personally? This time he said nothing. You are quite right, of course. Your contacts with the upper echelon of NATO and with the British and American high commands would have been worth every centime of the extravagant salary you were offered. As for bribes... She smiled then suddenly, and it altered her face entirely, making her seem many years younger, and there was a warmth and a sense of fun that he would not have suspected. This is a capitalist society, General. We prefer to talk about commissions and introducers' fees. He found himself smiling back at her, not because of what she had said, but simply because her smile was irresistible. However, I give you my solemn word that you would never have been expected to offer or carry. No, since Lockheed were indiscreet, it has changed. Nothing disreputable could ever be traced back to Namco. And certainly not to the top men there. Certainly not to you. It's all academic now, Peter pointed out. I've refused the offer. I disagree, General Stride. The brim of the hat covered her eyes as she looked down. I hope that when you hear what I had hoped to achieve, you may reconsider. I made the error of trying to keep us at arm's length to begin with. I relied on the generosity of the offer to sway you. I do not usually misjudge people so dismally. And she looked up and smiled again, and this time reached out and touched his arm. Her fingers were like her limbs, long and slim, but they were delicately tapered, and the nails were shaped and lacquered to a glossy, fleshy pink. She left them on his arm as she went on speaking. My husband was an extraordinary man, a man of vast vision and strength and compassion. Because of that, they tortured and killed him. Her voice had sunk to a hoarse, catchy whisper. They killed him in the most vile manner. She stopped, but made no attempt to turn her head away. She was unashamed of the tears that filled both eyes, but did not break over the lower lids. She She did not even blink, and it was Peter who looked away first. Only then she moved her hand, slipping it lightly into the crook of Peter's elbow and coming beside him, so her hip almost touched his. "It will rain soon," she said, her voice level and controlled. "We should go down." And as they started, she went on talking. "The butchers who did that to Aaron went free, while an impotent society looked on, a society which has systematically stripped itself of defense against the next attack. America has virtually disbanded its intelligence system and so shackled and exposed what is left that it is powerless. Your own country is concerned only with its particular problems, as are we in the rest of Europe. There is no international approach to a problem that is international in scope. Atlas was a fine concept, limited as it was by the fact that it was a force that could only be used in retaliation, and then only in special circumstances. However, if they ever suspect that it exists, the denizens of the left will mass to tear it down like a hunting pack of hyena." She squeezed his arm lightly and looked sideways at him with a solemn slant of the emerald eyes. "Yes, General, I do know about Atlas, but do not ask me how." Peter said nothing, and they entered the forest, stepping carefully, for the path was slick and steep. "After the death of my husband, I began to think a great deal about how we could protect the world that we know, while still remaining within the laws which were first designed to do that. With Altman Industries, I had inherited a comprehensive system of international information gathering. Naturally, it was attuned almost entirely to commercial and industrial considerations." She went on talking in that low, intense voice that Peter found mesmeric, describing how she had gradually used her massive fortune and influence to reach across borders closed to most, to gain the overall view of the new world of violence and intimidation. "I was not tied by considerations such as that of Interpol, forbidden by suicidal laws to involve itself in any crime that has political motivation. It was only when I was able to pass on what I had learned that I found myself coming up against the same self-destructive state of mind that masquerades as democracy and individual freedom. Twice I was able to anticipate a terrorist strike and to warn the authorities. But intention is not a crime, I was told, and both the culprits were quietly escorted to the border and turned free, to prepare themselves almost openly for the next outrage. The world must wait and cringe for the next stroke, prohibited from making any preemptive strike to prevent it. And when it comes, they are hampered by confused national responsibilities and by the complicated concept of minimum force." The Baroness broke off. "But you know all this. You have written in depth of the same subject. It's interesting to hear it repeated." "I will come soon enough to the interesting part. But we are almost back at the house." "Come," Peter told her, and led her past the stables to the swimming pool pavilion. The surface of the heated pool steamed softly, and lush tropical plants were in odd contrast to the wintry scene beyond the glass walls. They sat side by side on a swing seat, close enough to be able to talk in subdued tones, but the intense mood was broken for the moment. She took off her hat, scarf and jacket, and tossed them onto the cane chair opposite, and she sighed as she settled back against the cushions. "I understand from Sir Stephen that he wants you to go into the bank." She slanted her eyes at him. "It must be difficult to be so sought after." "I don't think I have Stephen's reverence for money." "It's a readily acquired taste, General Stride," she assured him, "one that can become an addiction." At that moment, the children of both Stride brothers arrived in a storm of shouted repartee and laughter, which moderated only marginally when they realized that Peter and the Baroness were in the swing seat. Stephen's youngest son, bulging over the top of his costume with puppy fat, and with silver braces on his front teeth, rolled his eyes in their direction, and in a stage whisper told Melissa Jane, "Je t'aime, ma chérie, swoon, swoon." His accent was frighteningly bad, and he received a hissed rebuke and a shove in the small of the back that hurled him into the deep end of the pool. The Baroness smiled. "Your daughter is very protective." She turned slightly to examine Peter's face again. "Or is it merely jealousy?" Without waiting for an answer, she went straight on to ask another question. Against the background of shouts and splashes, Peter thought he had misheard. "What did you say?" he asked carefully, certain that his expression had revealed nothing, and she repeated, "Does the name Caliph mean anything to you?" He frowned slightly, pretending to consider, while his memory darted back to the terrible microseconds of mortal combat, of smoke and flame and gunfire, and a dark-haired girl in a scarlet shirt screaming, "Don't kill us! Caliph said we would not die! Caliph!" and his own bullets stopping the rest of it, smashing into the open mouth. The word had haunted him since then, and he had tried a thousand variations, looking for sense and meaning, considering the possibility that he had misheard. Now he knew he had not. "Caliph?" he asked, not knowing why he was going to deny it, merely because it seemed vital that he keep something in reserve, that he were not carried headlong on the torrent of this woman's presence and personality. "It's a Mohammedan title, I think. It literally means the heir of Mohammed, the successor to the Prophet." "Yes," she nodded impatiently. "It's the title of a civil and religious leader. But have you heard it used as a code name?" "No. I'm sorry, I haven't. What's the significance?" "I'm not sure. Even my own sources are obscure and confused." She sighed, and they watched Melissa Jane in silence. The child had been waiting for Peter's attention, and when she had it, she ran lightly out along the springboard and launched herself, light as a swallow in flight, into a clean 1.5 somersault, entering the water with hardly a ripple, and surfacing immediately with fine pale hair slicked down across her face, immediately looking again for Peter's approval. "She's a lovely child," said the Baroness. "I have no children. Aaron wanted a son, but there wasn't one." And there was real sorrow in the green eyes that she masked quickly. Across the pool, Melissa Jane climbed from the pool and quickly draped a towel around her shoulders, covering her bosom, which was now large enough and yet so novel as to provide her with a constant source of embarrassment and shy pride. "Caliph," Peter reminded the Baroness quietly, and she turned back to him. "I first heard the name 2 years ago in circumstances I shall never forget." She hesitated. "May I take it that you are fully aware of the circumstances surrounding my husband's kidnapping and murder? I do not wish to repeat the whole harrowing story unless it is necessary." "I know it," Peter assured her. "You know that I delivered the ransom personally."
"Yes."
"The rendezvous was a deserted airfield near the East German border. They were waiting with a light twin-engined aircraft, a Russian-built reconnaissance machine with its markings sprayed over." Peter remembered the meticulous planning and the special equipment used in the hijacking of 070. It all tallied. "There were 4 men masked. They spoke Russian, or rather 2 of them spoke Russian. The other 2 never spoke at all. It was bad Russian." Peter remembered now that the Baroness spoke Russian and 5 other languages. She had a Middle European background. Peter wished he had studied her intelligence file more thoroughly. Her father had escaped with her from her native Poland when she was a small child. "Almost certainly the aircraft and the Russian were intended to cover their real identity," she mused. "I was with them for some little time. I had 45 million Swiss francs to deliver, and even in notes of large denomination, it was a bulky and heavy cargo to load aboard the aircraft. After the first few minutes when they realized I had no police escort, They relaxed and joked amongst themselves as they worked at loading the money. The word caliph was used in the English version in a Russian exchange that roughly translates as, "He was right again," and the reply, "Caliph is always right." Perhaps the use of the English word made me remember it so clearly. She stopped again. Grief, naked and bleak in the green eyes. "You told the police?" Peter asked gently. She shook her head. "No, I don't know why not. They had been so ineffectual up to that time. I was very angry and sad and confused. Perhaps even then I had already decided that I would hunt them myself, and this was all I had." "That was the only time you heard the name?" he asked. And she did not reply immediately. They watched the children at play, and it seemed fantasy to be discussing the source of evil in such surroundings, against a background of laughter and innocent high spirits. When the Baroness answered, she seemed to have changed direction completely. "There had been that hiatus in international terrorism. The Americans seemed to have beaten the hijacking problem with their Cuban agreement and the rigorous airport searches.